It's Friday afternoon. We've locked the door so no one will interrupt us while we contemplate a May in Indianapolis with no car races and no traffic related to car races. And also because it's time for another edition of our weekly podcast, Tales from the Brown Desk. I'm Jake Rigney of Rigney Law, LLC. With me, as usual, is my law partner, wife, and the reason I can't have nice things, Cassie Rigney. Our host is Terry Alm. Friendly reminder, Tales from the Brown Desk is a free-flowing conversation involving two foul-mouthed attorneys. It may include graphic descriptions of sexual activity, violence, and attempted meat theft. It may not be suitable for children, small animals, large animals, filthy animals, and George the Animal Steel. Listener discretion is advised. Here's Terry.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Jake. How are you?
I am embarrassed due to my repeated mess-ups of the intro, which all had to be edited out. I'm ashamed of myself, I tell you.
The listeners won't notice.
Well, they will now because I just told them.
You admitted it.
Right.
How are you, Cassie?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
That wasn't very funny.
It wasn't, but at least she's fine during a pandemic. So today we're going to talk about OWIs, and we're going to jump right into it.
Okay.
And OWI is operating while intoxicated, and then there's a DUI, which is driving under the influence. Which terminology is right in Indiana, and is there a difference between the two?
The current language of the law is operating while intoxicated. I'm not sure for the entire reasons why they changed. DUI was also driving under the influence. I think the connotation with DUI was alcohol, operating while intoxicated. The way the law has been written has been developing to encompass all forms of intoxication, whether it's prescription drugs or marijuana or methamphetamine. So the proper term in Indiana is operating while intoxicated.
Yeah, it even includes being intoxicated on your love. No, it doesn't. That's a joke.
So for the police to know that you are intoxicated, how do they find that information out?
Well, it can happen a lot of different ways, but the most common way is they catch you breaking some minor traffic law and pull you over for that. And then when they see you during the part where they ask you for your license and registration, they notice some things that lead them to think you're intoxicated. And they're trained to look for those things. So they usually spot them, and then they go from there.
Well, you can get an OWI with different drugs intoxicating your body. Like, how can they tell what type of drug it is? Like, if it's alcohol or if you smoked weed and then hopped in a car, like, how would they be able to differentiate between the two? Or even prescription pills?
Well, so sometimes they can tell sort of a general class or a specific drug based on the type of things they notice. For example, one of the things they often do to people when they suspect they're intoxicated is a test called the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, which is a big fancy way of saying they check your eyes to see if they shake or not. Because when you're intoxicated on alcohol, for example, which is the most common way people get DUIs, your eyes stop working exactly correctly and they start wobbling a little. And they wobble a little, especially when you're looking to the left and the right. And they also don't track smoothly. So if they move something in front of your eye and you're supposed to watch it, your eye will sort of ratchet rather than moving smoothly. It'll just click, you know, it'll bounce, 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 bounce rather than move smoothly, horizontally. When you're intoxicated on marijuana, on the other hand, your eye will move perfectly smoothly horizontally, but it won't move correctly vertically.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just the neurological effect it has on people is different that way. So if they think someone's intoxicated on marijuana, a lot of times they'll do a vertical gaze nystagmus test where they check to see if your eyes track smoothly up and down rather than left and right. And that gives them some clue. But it's also true that sometimes they don't know exactly what you're on, and they don't have to know exactly what you're on. They just have to have probable cause to believe you're intoxicated. Then they go get a warrant, and the judge typically signs it, and then they will draw your blood, either, you know, by force or not.
Can you refuse the blood draw?
Well, you certainly can refuse. There's something in the state of Indiana called the implied consent law. And whether you are simply holding an Indiana driver's license or operating a vehicle on Indiana roads, you have kind of preliminarily consented to submit to a lawful request for a chemical test. And if you refuse that chemical test, regardless of anything else what happens, your license will be suspended for 1 year. And if it's your second DUI or your second refusal, it will be 2 years. And there is no hardship license for that. There's no, it's just straight suspended time.
Yeah, it's sort of like asking if you can refuse to be arrested. I mean, you can say you ain't going to do it, but if the police have a different idea, they will make it happen.
So what happens in Indiana to someone who is pulled over and is drunk or under the influence of a drug from, you mentioned some tests, is that the field sobriety test or is that something different?
Well, yeah, what Jake was referring to is the horizontal gaze nystagmus test is one of the, I think, three standard field sobriety tests that are commonly given that officers are trained on these kind of investigations. You get pulled over. The officer will probably ask you some questions, ask you to step from the vehicle. You know, with all of this time, he is gathering evidence against you. Are you shaking? Do you smell like alcohol? Do you pull yourself from the vehicle? Do you have to lean on the back of the car? And then he'll do the tests, which are further ways to gather evidence. All of this is get probable cause to either ask for the chemical test or to get a warrant if you refuse.
So the test starts at the beginning of the traffic stop, not once you're out of the car and they say they're going to give you a test?
I would say anytime you're encountering the police, I mean, they're there for a reason and they're taking note of everything. I mean, they're just taking note. They're observant. Don't think they just didn't come over because you're buddies and they want to know. I mean, if they notice something, they're going to follow that thread.
Right. The tests are a part of their investigation. The tests start when they start, but the investigation starts immediately. As soon as you roll down your window, because they're always looking for it. Obviously, pretty quickly, sometimes they realize that it isn't, and it's just a regular traffic stop, and they just go ahead and do the rest of it, write you a ticket or not. But they're trained to always be looking for those things. So the investigation starts immediately.
So let's say that they pulled someone over and they suspect that they are driving under the influence. Do the cops have a breathalyzer there on scene? Do they take your blood there on scene? How does that happen?
They do. They have a handheld device called a portable breath test, PBT is what they call it for short. And it is something they keep in their car. They have a little mouthpiece that they use for each person. They pull it out of a little plastic wrapper, plug it into the box. They have you blow through it, and then it gives them an alcohol reading. That is useful for their investigative purposes because they can then use it to exclude alcohol, for example. If they're seeing intoxication but they think it's not alcohol, they can confirm it with that, but the result is not admissible in court against you, so they can't come into court later and say what you blew in it.
So what kind of evidence do they use in court against you for driving while intoxicated if they can't use the breathalyzer results?
So you get all their observations, plus those three, the three standard field sobriety tests, which are the horizontal gaze nystagmus that we already talked about, the nine-step walk and turn, and the one-leg stand. Each one of those tests is difficult. Each one of them, especially the two that aren't the eye test, are difficult, and they're trained to be looking for all the different ways you'll fail it, and then they note all those. If they get failures on those tests, they can get a warrant and or compel you to give a breath or blood test, and then from there, you'll get lab results back that'll tell you, you know, whether or not a person was intoxicated, what was in their blood.
Are the blood tests admissible in court?
If the blood test was taken lawfully, then yeah, absolutely.
When you say it was taken lawfully, so there's been times in the past where people's blood has been taken from them unlawfully?
I can only assume that it has been. I mean, you either give consent or you don't. But I mean, I'm certain that there have been times where people have samples taken from them forcefully by the police. I mean, I don't have a specific instance for you, but it's a bodily invasion that requires search warrant or consent.
Now, going back to the field sobriety test, are there any things someone can do to get extra credit during these tests?
No, there is no extra credit for it. In fact, and just speaking personally, I would almost definitely never take them. You don't have to. You're unlikely to pass them sober or drunk. I know I am unlikely to pass them sober or drunk. And all I'd be doing is give them more evidence against me. So I would almost certainly tell the officer that I wasn't going to do those things. But you know, people think that if they do it, then you know they might get to go home. And so they take their shot. But it's, yeah, I see a lot more people fail them than pass them.
And that's something, you know, going back to the implied consent, and you can refuse to do the field sobriety test, and there's not a legal consequence to that. You can refuse them. What you cannot refuse to do without legal consequences, take the certified chemical test, which is choice of the officer. That's either a breath test that you do like at a police department or the drawing of your blood. Though the certified test is what you cannot refuse, or you'll get a driver's license suspension. The field sobriety test you can refuse.
Is there a certain phrase you would recommend someone use to tell the cops they don't want to do this test, just to not be disrespectful to the cops and maybe work in their favor?
I would just say something along the lines of I'm not taking those tests, or no thanks.
Okay. So let's say someone was pulled over because a cop suspected that they were intoxicated and they took these tests and they failed them. They blew in a breathalyzer and it shows that they are under the influence of alcohol. What happens to that person next? Are they cuffed and put in the car and taken to jail? What happens to their car?
Well, generally, what you described is actually just the investigation. At that point, then they would be read Indiana implied consent, and then you would expect them to be taken either to the police department to do the certified chemical test or to the hospital for a blood draw. And even if it's a strong investigation, if they can get that kind of evidence, a chemical test, they're going to want to collect that evidence. And that would be in the ideal investigation, I would expect that would be the next step, would be the admissible chemical test. When they put you in custody, I mean, that kind of question is you know, an officer to officer kind of thing. You know, you may have somebody who's put in cuffs during an investigation who's never arrested. You may have somebody who goes through this whole thing and they never put cuffs on them before they are in the drunk tank, you know, behind bars in the police station. So That's kind of that's a hard question to ask. And don't, you know, I hate to have say those things because you get people and be like, well, I heard and you can't cuff me, blah, blah. They, if the officer is in fear as part of his investigation, he could put cuffs on you. And that may or may not mean, you know, you're going to jail or not. I don't know. But
so let's say they decided to arrest you because you failed the test. They're pretty sure you're under the influence of alcohol. What happens to your vehicle?
They will typically tow it unless you managed to park it legally in a place that it can stay. But yeah, otherwise they call a wrecker and they tow your truck or your car, and they'll search it before they do that. So sometimes they find additional evidence against you when they're doing that, either evidence that you were possessing something else in your car you shouldn't have, or they'll find, you know, empty alcohol containers or something like that that makes you look worse. So that's usually what happens to your car.
You will also be held, oftentimes first-time offenders, OWIs, you're just going to get OR'd out, but they will hold you in custody until you are at least under the legal limit. They've got to hold you till you sober up.
What does OR mean?
Oh, released on your own recognizance, meaning that you're not going to have to pay money to be released from custody. You're released on your promise to come back.
Now, let's say that there was a child in the car. What happens to the child? They're not going to tow the car with the kid in it, right?
Yes, they have a specific tow yard where they take nothing but cars with small children in them. And they're kept there and fed and watered until, no, they don't do that. First of all, if you have a child in your car while you're driving while intoxicated, it increases the level of your offense. So where that would normally just be an A misdemeanor, it becomes a level 6 felony if you have a child in the car. Typically, I believe what they try to do is find the other parent so that, or another responsible adult who can come pick up the child. But if they can't, or if there just isn't anyone that can come do that, then, you know, because, for example, Chad's grandma is also drunk or whatever, then they call the Department of Child Services and the child goes into foster care, at least for a little while. So it can have really devastating, you know, results, and it just really unfortunate situations can come up in that scenario.
So let's say, for example, somebody was pulled over and they're being arrested for an OWI, and it's the first time they've ever received such a charge. How bad is that for them? Like, what can they expect as far as penalties and consequences?
Generally, it's not going to result in any time in jail beyond the initial night of the arrest. Generally, you know, obviously that's not a problem. You could go to jail for up to 365 days on an A misdemeanor. However, after that, it's most of the time a probation matter. However, there's potential treatment. There's classes you have to take. If you get a license suspension, you want the specialized driving privilege, you know, you have to have special insurance. They might demand an interlock device on your car, one of the things you have to breathe into. It's very costly. The way I describe it to clients, they want it to be, it's not supposed to ruin your life, but they want it to be painful enough so that you never come back. They don't want you to ever come back. And it costs a lot of money on top of what you would pay an attorney. And it's time consuming, and it's going to be a major frustration in your life. It's probably the strictest or toughest sentencing you'll get of any misdemeanor, in my opinion.
How bad can it be for someone who has 2 OWI charges? And does the time in between the charges mean anything?
Okay, so you mean 2 different incidences, not one incident that had multiple charges.
Right.
Okay. Anytime, it's 7 years now. You have first incident results in a conviction. You get picked up anytime within the following 7 years. that will then be a felony, a level 6 felony charge. It will be enhanced for your prior conviction. If it's outside of that 7, whether it's inside or outside of that 7, you have to do 5 days in jail or 240 hours of community service.
So if Indiana man wanted to live up to Florida man this week, what would happen to Indiana man if he did what Florida man did and got arrested 2 times in 1 week for driving while intoxicated?
Well, so Indiana, and I've seen this happen, actually. I think I had a person I was prosecuting who picked up 3 in like a month or something like that. So they're all misdemeanors, which is the first thing. Which seems weird, but until you've been convicted of one, they can't enhance the other ones. So all 3 would be misdemeanors, but their Indiana man's bond or release on his own recognizance, if he didn't have a bond, can potentially be revoked for the 2nd and 3rd arrests. So there's a point where if you keep doing that, even in the more liberal type places like Indianapolis, that you will be held on a bond you can't make or no bond until your cases are resolved. And it destroys any leverage you have to try to get the prosecutor to do anything different or a little easier or better for you. Because when he knows you're in custody and that you'll take anything to get out, he has no incentive to cut you breaks or try to get it over with quick, because he knows that if he just walks away from the negotiation, you'll just be sitting in jail, and that's worse than whatever you're going to get anyway. So you destroy all your leverage to negotiate when you do stuff like that.
So what would be the penalties for someone who received 2 OWIs within a 7-year time frame in Indiana?
I mean, it's a level 6 felony, so it's 6 months up to 2.5 years, probation, jail time, home detention, you know, any range of penalties that come along with that.
How likely is it for someone who received an OWI to spend time in jail? Like, how many do you have to get to sit in jail, or is it common to just get OWIs and not do much jail time?
That's just not a kind of question that an attorney can answer. Each jurisdiction is different. Each judge is different. You know, you're going to get treated differently regarding bond and custody post-conviction in Marion County than you are in a rural county. So that's why oftentimes you ask me these questions. I'm like, well, this is the minimum, this is the maximum, because any of those are possible. And it just kind of depends, you know, where did you get arrested? I don't know. Maybe, and then I can tell you, well, you're more likely to get towards this or that. But I mean, there's not hard and fast answers to these questions.
Yeah, I get these sorts of questions from people who call a lot. And I tell most of them about the same thing, which is, you know, I'd love to be able to tell you this is what's going to happen and that I can guarantee you that. But there are no guarantees in criminal law. And if you find a lawyer that will give you a guarantee that this is going to happen or that's going to happen, you should turn and run, because that lawyer does not know what they're talking about. It is rife with the opportunity for unpredictable things to happen, because every case is a little bit different and every person's life leading up to their case is different. And so they have different backgrounds and different histories. And sometimes they did or said something bad to the judge at the beginning of their case too. So, which can create additional uphill problems. So we never know for sure what's going to happen. All we can do, and this is, like I said, this is what I tell them. I can't guarantee you what's going to happen. I can guarantee you I'll do what I can to help. And that's sort of where we're stuck.
Now, what about a 3rd OWI charge? Do the penalties get harder? Do the consequences come on a person stronger? Like, how many of these charges can someone rack up? How many OWIs have you seen on one person's record?
You know, when I was a prosecutor, I had a case in court 9, I think, where the guy had something like 10 or 15, somewhere in there.
Wow.
The progressive penalties for priors stop going up at a level 6 felony. And the mandatory minimums stop going up after 2. And the minimum for that is 10 actual days. Yeah, 10 actual days in jail. But that doesn't change the fact that the judge has discretion to give you a worse sentence. For example, I think the guy who had 10 or 15, he got like a year and a half in prison.
Well, something else, once you start racking up multiple convictions, then you're going to start facing administrative consequences, which is what the BMV is, an administrative body, and they can take action against you that's not considered criminal. They can adjudge you a habitual traffic offender and suspend your license, and that's something they can do separate of any criminal case. So that's additional.
Yeah, and in fact, you can lose your license for 5 years even with just one DUI. If you have one major offense like a DUI or a reckless driving or even, I think, driving while suspended and 9 tickets within a 10-year period, then you're a habitual traffic violator and the Bureau will administratively suspend your license for 5 years. If you pick up 3 majors, which would include your 3 DUI scenario, they'll suspend your license administratively for 10 years. So there are large collateral consequences sometimes to these things that there's not a lot you can do about, especially if you've already pled guilty.
Is a lifetime suspension a thing?
Not anymore. And if people are out there living under a lifetime suspension, give us a call because after 10 years, we can help you get that done. The legislature has recognized that lifetime suspensions just aren't generally even good for the community. Just people can't function in today's society. So it's maxed out at 10-year suspensions.
Right. There are people out there in the community who are suspended for life. They changed the law, I think, in 2014 and did away with lifetime suspensions. So new people are not getting lifetime suspensions. But the people who got them before still have them, and those weren't vacated just because they changed the law. So the people from who had their license forfeited for life before 2014 are still suspended for life. And some of them aren't even eligible to have their lifetime suspension rescinded yet. You have to go 10 years, I think, although it depends on how you got there, I think. I think sometimes you can get it done after 3. But, lifetime suspension used to be a thing and still is for some people who are living out there. You got it when you were convicted of the D felony, operating as a habitual traffic violator. So, the 5 and 10 year suspension I just described is called a habitual traffic violator suspension. If you get caught driving on that, it was a D felony, still a level 6 felony. And as a result of that conviction, if it stayed a felony, your license would be forfeited for life. And then if you got caught driving on your lifetime forfeiture, that was a level C felony, a class C felony back in the day. So it carried a penalty of 2 to 8 years in prison just for driving.
Wow. So I know you too, as criminal defense attorneys, handle a lot of OWI cases defending people that the charges have been brought against. What are some typical defenses that you look into when you're building your case for your clients?
Well, DUIs are a lot of fun because there's oftentimes a lot up for a defense attorney to work with in defending the case. There's lots of things that happen that implicate the Fourth Amendment, which is you hear motions to suppress. Was the initial traffic stop just legally justified? Was did the investigation unfold legally? Were the field sobriety tests administered properly? Was the chemical test administered properly? Were they in fact intoxicated, or is there some kind of problem with the chemical test? Is there some other reason for the observations that the officer would claim to have? So whether it's intoxication, then there's also, were they really operating? I mean, you get a lot of things, you know, well, the car was parked, you know, were the keys in the ignition, was it running, you know, those kind of things. So operation, intoxication, then anytime, you know, the contact with the police, did they handle that aspect lawfully?
So as far as operating, what if someone was sitting in the car, drunk, just sitting in a parking lot, or even their garage?
Sitting in their car, it would depend. If their car was running, in particular if it was in gear and they had their foot on the brake, definitely. If their car's in park and it's running, probably, yeah. And that's... although I have seen some prosecutors who are a little hesitant to charge that. But look, operating a motor vehicle, it's still a 2,000-pound piece of plastic, metal, and glass, right? You shouldn't be behind the wheel of your car, even if you're not doing anything with it while you're intoxicated, because it's dangerous. It's dangerous for you, and it's dangerous for the other people you live with. So even in your garage, it's dangerous for you in your house. That's typically still illegal.
And it's one of those things, you know, people think that they're going to get real clever and, you know, they're in a one car accident and, you know, the police roll up and they're not in the car. And but it's kind of like, well, where did you in your car? How did they in there? You know, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So, you know, like you don't actually have to be caught, you know, puking your guts out, driving the wrong way down a one-way street. I mean, it's a global, you know, is it reasonable? You know, they can make a prove a case of operation even if you're not actually behind the wheel of your car moving on the roadway. I mean, it's a fact-sensitive situation. So it's a big difference, you know, if you're in your car versus a public parking lot, you know. Did you drive? Where are you going? You know, were you getting something out of your car? Were you fighting with your family member just listening to music in your driveway? Or, you know, if you're in a public place, how did you get there? You know, it's less likely to think that you were doing something innocent, not moving, if you're in a public place.
Could you get an OWI for driving a golf cart drunk?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. A golf cart is a motor vehicle. And in fact, the statute doesn't even say motor vehicle anymore. It just says vehicle. And so, yes, it is, any vehicle, which is anything that is essentially pushed by a mechanical scheme, is a vehicle. So that includes, scooters, bicycles, mopeds, and golf carts, yeah.
Let's say there are two people in a car. The driver is not drunk, not under the influence of any drugs, but there's a passenger drinking. Is that okay?
Well, the passenger's not allowed to have an open container in a vehicle. So if he's drinking in the car, that's illegal. That's, I think, a C misdemeanor. But the passenger is not operating the vehicle in that scenario, so they wouldn't get an OWI. It is also possible to get a public intoxication charge from riding in a car while intoxicated. There was, I think, a somewhat high-profile, at least among lawyers, case several years ago where a woman was a passenger in a taxi. And she ended up getting arrested for public intoxication. or she was a passenger in a car. That's what it was. She was a passenger in a car, and she got arrested for public intoxication. It was understanding how those investigations go. What happened is the driver of the car was also intoxicated. And so they couldn't let her drive the car away because she was also drunk and it was in a bad neighborhood. So they didn't, I don't think the officer felt comfortable letting her walk to wherever she needed to go in that neighborhood. So he felt like, my guess is he felt like the only thing he could do was arrest her for public intoxication. Then some prosecutor filed the case, which they don't usually do, but they did. And it went to trial, and she lost the trial. It went to the Court of Appeals, and I'm pretty sure she lost there, too. That caused the legislature to change the public intoxication statute so that those types of things didn't happen anymore. And now there's an element where you have to be bothering somebody in a public intoxication situation. So now being drunk in public on its own is not a crime unless you are harassing, annoying, or... yeah, there's some third element. I can't remember what it is. Endangering yourself or someone else.
So have either of you two seen those, I don't even know what they call them. They're like these multi-people bikes that are riding around Indianapolis, but they're like bar bikes where people are pedaling and drinking. Like, how is that okay?
Please tell me that Florida man is going to get involved in the pickled peddler here in a second.
To be honest, the person driving is not drinking. That's like the proprietor, at least of the ones that I've seen, is that there is someone who's actually serving the alcohol and I assume works for, you know, what do they call it? Bar, whatever they're called, as an employee. So certainly if that person was drinking and they were intoxicated, yes, they could. But the people who are drunk are the motion of the pedals. They're not steering the vehicle.
Yeah, and if you look closely at those things, you'll notice they have engines. They're not like, I don't think they run on gas. They're probably electric. But I'm not even sure that the people who pedal are doing anything.
They just let them.
I think they're just like, oh no, it's exercise. Here's some pedals. To be honest, I think it's probably against the law because it's having an open container in a motor vehicle, which most likely everyone who's doing that is committing a C misdemeanor. At the same time, I've never heard the police suggest they needed to start enforcing that. And as long as people are doing it and they aren't throwing beers at people as they go by and or yelling and screaming and they keep it to, you know, when the sun's up and not like in the middle of the night driving through neighborhoods and stuff, who cares, right? This is why the police have some discretion about whether to enforce laws or not. And it's so that we can keep letting the motorized beer seller guy drive people around. Who cares? It's fine. Let him do it.
So would it be fine to hop on a bike and drink? like a bicycle, not a motorcycle, but a bicycle with pedals. It's got to be fine then, right?
Well, I think that it's also illegal. Just like being inside the pickled peddler is, but, you know, I don't think you're usually going to get in trouble for it. Especially if you're not doing something stupid and you don't hurt anyone, but you can get a DUI on a bike. So,
well, and that's something that, and this is where, why it's not so easy to be a lawyer. You're mixing two issues. The pickled peddler, you've got the drunk people as the power and then the person steering. So the person who's steering isn't intoxicated. But if you're drunk and biking, that's the same person doing the same thing. They're two separate issues. So, I mean, that's where, yeah, no. If you're intoxicated, you're not supposed to be in charge of maneuvering something that can hurt you or somebody else is kind of the gist.
We've had numerous people call recently asking if there's a way to like expunge their driving record. Is that a thing? I don't know if they have like OWIs or a whole bunch of tickets, but they specifically want to erase their record, driving record.
There is a statute that allows for the expungement of certain driving offenses, but it is not a very user-friendly statute. I don't think it actually helps very many people. And I, even though we've gotten a lot of calls about it, I don't think I've ever actually been hired to do it because the statute doesn't provide a lot of relief.
Well, because the thing is, it's sealing it, and they have, you can't have admitted them. It's, you know, in a expungement, you're like, okay, I did this. I, you know, whether I admitted guilt or however you were, you're coming back. You're not fighting the conviction. You're just like, this has been enough time. And on those, if you want to seal it on an infraction, it had to have been dismissed or overturned on appeal. So if you admitted it, you're not eligible to seal your driving record.
And paying the fine is the same as admitting it. That's, paying the fine is admitting it. So, you know, if you paid the tickets, you can't get them expunged.
So did either of you hear that earlier this week in Utah, the cops were pulling over this SUV because they suspected that the driver was intoxicated? But when they go up and question the driver is a kid. He's a 5-year-old boy driving on the interstate on his way to California to buy a Lamborghini because his mother wouldn't buy him one.
Yeah, so this... I've heard about this kid, and I want to say our phone number is 317-430-7370, and we have a 4.5-year-old daughter. She's going to be the daughter of two lawyers, so because that kid needs to be my future son-in-law. That's awesome. I'm sorry, but my daughter is now betrothed. That kid's amazing. He's my hero.
I don't know how you'd reach the pedals.
Yeah, that, or see over to be able to steer.
Or to know the cop was pulling him over, and he pulled over on the interstate for the cop.
That's why this kid's my hero. He's obviously, he figured out things that three grown adults can't figure out. We don't understand how he did it. And he's just like, oh, shit, the cops are here. I guess I better pull over.
No, he reminds me of the kid that took his grandma's car. Wasn't that the I like to do hood rat stuff with my friends kid?
Yes, that was that kid. Yep. Why did you do it? Because I like to do bad stuff with my friends. Smoking with cigarettes.
Yep.
So Florida man was having fun with his brother this week, and both of them ended up getting a DUI, I think it's called a DUI in Florida, for the same vehicle. Have you ever heard of such a thing happening?
Was one sitting on the other's lap?
No. The cops were called about a reckless driver, and when they showed up, this vehicle was pulled over, and the driver got out. And while he got out, his brother, who is also under the influence, got in the driver's seat. So they both ended up with DUIs.
Did he take off?
Yeah, he tried to take off.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
That's it. So that wraps up this episode of Tales from the Brown Desk.
Thanks, Terry. And thank you for listening to Tales from the Brown Desk. Please note, while we may discuss legal issues and provide information regarding the law to our listeners, we do not intend to create an attorney-client relationship with any listener. Our advice may not be applicable to some legal issues. Please consult with an attorney you have hired to review your legal situation before you attempt to apply the things we have said to your case. If you'd like to schedule a free consultation with one of us regarding a criminal law matter, please call us at 317-430-7370. If you'd like to submit a question for our podcast, please send an email to teri@rigneylawindy.com. Please title your email podcast question. No names are necessary. The attorneys at Rigney Law do not comment on their current pending cases. Nothing we have said in this podcast is a comment on a case we are currently working on, even if your name is Chad or if you are a man from Florida. Thanks. Take care.